Coming up on Star Stuff, NASA's Dawn spacecraft successfully achieves orbit insertion around an asteroid. The planet Neptune celebrates a birthday. It's been one Neptunian year, that's 165 Earth years, since its discovery. And Atlantis wrapping up the last ever mission of the space shuttle era. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
History's been made with the first ever successful orbit insertion of a spacecraft around a main-belt asteroid. NASA's Dawn spacecraft has now commenced circling the asteroid Vesta some 188 million kilometres from Earth. The main asteroid belt lies between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Dawn will study Vesta for a year. The observations it makes will help scientists better understand some of the earliest chapters of our solar system's history. NASA Mission Control says the Dawn spacecraft was captured by Vesta's gravitational pull at approximately 1500 on Saturday afternoon, Australian Eastern Standard Time. At the time, the probe was some 16,000 kilometres from the asteroid. Confirmation telemetry was received at 16:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time on Sunday during a scheduled communications pass. Launched in September 2007, Dawn has taken nearly 4 years to reach the asteroid. And according to mission managers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, the spacecraft is on target and performing nominally. Engineers have been subtly shaping Dawn's trajectory for years in order to match Vesta's orbit around the Sun. Unlike other missions where dramatic propulsive burns put a spacecraft into orbit around a planet, Dawn was sort of eased up next to Vesta, allowing the asteroid's gravity to actually do the job of capturing the spacecraft into orbit. After a year in orbit around Vesta, Dawn will fire up her engines and fly to a second asteroid, the dwarf planet Ceres. That'll be in July 2012. Glenn Nagel from NASA's Deep Space Communications Centre near Canberra says the mission will make Dawn the only spacecraft to have orbited two asteroids.
It is quite an amazing mission. In fact, this is the very first time we'll have a spacecraft that will go to a destination, go into orbit, or effectively a big corkscrewing orbit around that object, and then a year later refire its engines and head off to a new destination. So with the capabilities of the Dawn spacecraft and its ion plasma drive system, gives us this opportunity to really start exploring different parts of the solar system.
It's been a long mission, hasn't it? It's been 4 years since Dawn first blasted off.
Yeah, it took off in September 2007, a long journey over a 3 billion kilometre flight path looping around the solar system, reached the asteroid belt just over a year ago, the inner parts of those belts, and has been weaving its way through, I suppose is a good way to think about it, and heading off to what is the largest asteroid in the belt, and that is Vesta, and that's where we're now safely in orbit.
And after Vesta goes to Ceres. Ceres is, well, it used to be an asteroid. These days they refer to it as a dwarf planet, don't they?
Yeah, when it was first discovered, it was the largest, brightest object actually in the asteroid belt, along with Vesta and another asteroid called Pallas. And they wanted to learn a little bit more about that really big world out there. But when Pluto got changed over in its designation to become not a planet but a dwarf planet, Ceres got changed from being an asteroid to become one of these dwarf planets, the closest to us. So these worlds are really sort of the building blocks, the things that over time clump together in the early solar system to build planets like Earth and Mars and others. But these are worlds that just didn't get that far. And we want to understand a few things. One, we want to learn about their process, you know, their role in the process of building planets. But we also want to understand why didn't all that material in the asteroid belt clump up to become another planet.
And of course, there's the other question too. Why is it that one of these two bodies is a very dry place and the other one has lots of frozen moisture in it? Does this mean they were formed in different parts of the solar system and then somehow came together in the one asteroid belt?
There are a lot of questions, and some astronomers speculate that Ceres may have this ice, snow, frost material on its surface because being a larger object and nearly double the size of Vesta, that it's an object that has attracted attracted more material to it, other comets, other icy bodies that might have been in its region. So we actually do see, strangely, seasonal changes on Ceres as it orbits around the Sun. That's been detected through observations from the Hubble Space Telescope. But even at Hubble's best resolution, we're still seeing a fuzzy, blurry sort of light and shade. Now, this will be a chance for the Dawn mission to get up close and personal. And already, we're getting some wonderful pictures from Vesta showing deep craters and grooves, pits on its surface, and an amazing mountain-like peak at its south pole, the effect of a large impact on that world from billions of years ago.
And of course, there's always the possibility that Ceres may not have formed anywhere near the asteroid belt at all, but been dragged in from forming further out near Neptune or somewhere.
Yeah, another interesting thought is that Jupiter's and Saturn's gravitational influence, which occasionally give kicks to the asteroids and the Trojan asteroids, which are in the sort of leading and trailing orbits of worlds like Jupiter, but that some of the outer worlds, like Neptune and Uranus, may have had some of these rocky, icy worlds, something along the lines of Ceres, but these little gravitational tugs over billions of years from the giant planets have actually shifted these worlds out of orbits and actually dragged Ceres into the inner part of the solar system, into the asteroid belt. So there's lots of intriguing thoughts and ideas. I'm certain we will learn more as we continue to study them.
And what about the instruments needed to do this sort of research?
There is a really high-quality framing camera. So this is the imaging system for the spacecraft that will take high-resolution images of the surface. We also have a visible and infrared spectrometer on board. This will start to show us the composition of the materials that are actually make up that world. There's a gamma-ray and neutron spectrometer that will basically look at the neutrons that are reflected back off the surface. So as particles from the Sun actually strike the surface, they bounce off all neutrons, and the instrument on the spacecraft can then detect those and get an understanding of the exact composition of the materials, the actual surface composition. And we're also doing gravity science. So as we orbit around, we'll look at variations in the orbit of the spacecraft as it does this spiraling orbit with the asteroid, and we'll get an idea of the density of that particular world, look at anomalies, changes, because it's not a spherical world. It sort of looks like a bit of a squashed ball at one end. That will help us understand a little bit more about the orbital mechanics of being able to go to worlds like these with future missions.
That's Glenn Nagle from NASA's Deep Space Network Communications Centre near Canberra. The planet Neptune celebrating a birthday of sorts. It was a year ago that the eighth most distant planet from the Sun was discovered. That's a Neptunian year we're talking about, 165 Earth years. What it means is that it's the first time since its discovery that the planet's reached the same point in its orbit it was back then. Neptune was the first planet discovered after being predicted by scientists using mathematics rather than telescopes. It was actually Uranus which led to Neptune's discovery. It was British astronomer William Herschel and his sister Caroline who first discovered Uranus in 1781. Shortly afterwards, Herschel noticed the orbit of Uranus wasn't matching the predictions of Newton's theory of gravity. Then in 1821, French astronomer Alex Bouvard speculated another planet was tugging on Uranus, altering its orbital motion. 20 years later, astronomers Urbain Le Verrier from France and John Couch Adams from England independently predicted the location of this mystery planet by measuring how the gravity of a hypothetical object would affect the orbit of Uranus. Le Verrier then sent his predictions of the mystery planet's location to German astronomer Johann Gottfried Galle at the Berlin Observatory. And on the 23rd of September 1846, Galle found and identified Neptune as a planet. Of course, technically, he wasn't the first person to actually see Neptune. That honour goes to Galileo Galilei. You see, back in December 1612, while observing Jupiter and its moons, Galileo recorded Neptune in his notebook, but he listed it as a star. The next month, he noted that this star appeared to have moved in relation to other stars. But because Galileo failed to identify Neptune as a planet, he can't really be credited with its discovery. Planetary scientist Dr. Craig O'Neill from Sydney's Macquarie University says we really haven't learnt all that much more about Neptune since then.
Neptune's one of those black holes in our observational database still, unfortunately. you know, since the original measurements were made, the big leap forward with Neptune was the Voyager missions and probably the Hubble Space Telescope. And they tell us a little bit about its composition, but not much. A little bit about the cloud cover, rotation, its magnetic field, but again, just enough to make it interesting, but not enough to really solve anything. But, yeah, I mean, the long and short of it is we know not a great deal more than what they did when they first discovered it back in Le Verrier's time in 1846.
We know Triton, for example, has cryovolcanics. That must be pretty exciting to have seen those images from Voyager.
Yeah, I mean, Triton is spectacular. It's one of the great things about being able to see the surface of a body like that is you can actually have a look at its history and deduct things like that which have happened. But Neptune, of course, being covered by such a thick hydrogen, helium and other things like methane atmosphere just obscures anything which is going on below.
Is it the methane which makes it look blue?
That's the running theory. Methane absorbs really well in the infrared and red parts of the spectrum, which would give you this blue haze. The big question, of course, is Uranus has a very similar atmospheric composition to Neptune. It has trace methane there as well, which is what gives it its cyan kind of colour.
Yeah.
But the question is, why are the two so different? We don't really know. There's a little bit probably more methane in the upper atmosphere of Neptune. It's a little oversaturated in methane compared to Uranus, which is undersaturated. That may have something to do with it, but long and short of it is there's still a little bit of a question mark as to why Neptune really is quite as blue as it is.
And of course, the thing everybody remembers about Neptune is the scooter from the Voyager shots.
Yeah, absolutely. It was pretty exciting. Well, that and the great black spot as well, the great dark spot.
The great dark spot, yes.
Yeah,
and the fastest winds in the solar system.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's about the extent of my Voyager knowledge.
That's about the extent of, I think, most people's Voyager knowledge, even if you worked on it. I mean, yeah, the winds themselves are just something incredible. They're almost pushing, you know, 2,000 kilometres an hour in places, which for something that far out and that far away from the sun, I mean, it's getting so little solar radiation, the sun can't be powering most of what's happening in Neptune's atmosphere.
Do we have any idea what's causing those winds?
Perfectly honest, no. Not really at all. The running theory, particularly, you know, given Uranus is pretty mild, one way of looking at it is Uranus is losing about 1.1 times more energy than it gets from the sun. So there's a little bit of heat loss from the planet, but not a great deal. I bet you what you'd expect for something lying out there. But Neptune's losing over around 2.5 times as much heat as the sun's actually dumping into it, which is a big amount of heat to lose. And that's what's powering all this atmosphere. And the question is, where's all this energy coming from? Where's all this heat coming from? Long and short of it is we don't know. The standard, you know, running explanation whenever you see an unexplained source of heat is, oh, it's probably a bit of radioactive, you know, heat decay by some radioactive elements down in the rocky core or something. And that's plausible, but raises the question as to why Uranus is different again. There are a few other weirder sources of heat. It's been proposed that methane, if you put it under enough pressure deeper down in Neptune, it actually could convert to diamond, and those little diamonds would rain out of the atmosphere into the ocean below. And by doing that, you'd actually release latent heat. When you convert one phase to another, you dump a whole bunch of heat, and that could potentially be powering some of these winds. That's a little more speculative, but, you know, speculation is basically where we're at.
It's the best we've got at the moment.
Yeah, in terms of our planetary formation models, that's what you'd expect out there.
If I was standing on Triton and it wasn't too cold, and I looked at the sun, what would the sun look like from there?
The sun's essentially a point-sized object, just a large bright star in the sky by the time you're out of Neptune. Any further out than that, then it would look like an exceptionally bright star, but completely unrecognizable compared to the sun we see every day on the Earth. From the surface of, say, Triton, around Neptune's orbit, the sun basically would look like a bright star in the sky, something about as bright as Venus would be in the evening sky on Earth.
That's Dr. Craig O'Neill, a planetary scientist with Sydney's Macquarie University. Well, imagine being caught in a thunderstorm as wide as the Earth with discharges of lightning 10,000 times more powerful than normal, flashing 10 times per second at its peak. Now, imagine that this storm is still unfolding 8 months later. That's the amazing story which has been reported in the scientific journal Nature, which is describing how one of the most violent weather events in the solar system began erupting on Saturn last December and is still enthralling astronomers now. Two studies drawing on observations by both professional and amateur astronomers about this storm on Saturn. and the data is coming from a wide range of equipment, from relatively small ground-based telescopes through to NASA's Cassini spacecraft, which is orbiting the Saturnian system. Saturn, like Jupiter, is no stranger to convective storms. It too is a gas giant, a planet comprising of layers of thick rolling gas, rather than a rock like Mercury, Venus, Earth or Mars. The difference between Jupiter and Saturn, however, is that Jovian megastorms tend to erupt rather unexpectedly, but the Lord of the Rings gives birth to a monster storm virtually periodically. It occurs on average once every Saturnian year, which is approximately 29.5 Earth years. And it appears to be linked to the summer solstice, when the planet's orbit brings it just that bit closer to the sun, allowing its atmosphere to warm a little. The event's been called the Great White Spot, a sort of counterpart to the swirling Great Red Spot on Jupiter. It's called a Great White Spot because of the mass of brilliant white storm clouds that erupt in the upper atmosphere. The show's so big it can be clearly seen through telescopes from Earth. In the last 130 years, five of these storms have been observed. The last was in 1990. But the current Great White Spot is proving to be a dazzling spectacle, revealed by an unprecedented array of observational power at hand. Events began back on December the 5th. Ground-based telescopes detected a barely visible white point on a normally unblemished and hazy part of Saturn's northern hemisphere, at approximately latitude 35 degrees north. At the same time, the Cassini spacecraft began picking up radio emissions caused by lightning from the storm. Within a few weeks, this little point had ballooned out to a massive storm, 10,000 kilometers wide. It's roughly the size of the Earth, and after 2 months, the clouds had almost completely encircled the planet. Analysis of the data suggests the spot is in fact a cluster of superstorms, produced by the upwelling of heat, moisture, and ammonia from water clouds from lower down in Saturn's atmosphere where the pressure is high. As this mix rises into a cooler atmospheric layer called the tropopause, bright white clouds of ammonia begin spreading horizontally into a tail, sculpted by eastward jets of wind. Astronomers are especially intrigued by the current Great White Spot. Observational history of this phenomenon is sketchy, but evidence suggests this present spot is both exceptionally intense and rather premature because it was still spring on Saturn when the storm started brewing. The data for the research includes high-resolution images provided by amateur astronomer Anthony Wesley. Wesley's also credited with the 2009 discovery of an asteroid slamming into Jupiter and last year's detection of a fireball crashing into the upper Jovian atmosphere. What makes his discoveries even more amazing is that he's using nothing more than a half-metre telescope in the backyard of his home near Canberra.
I just do what I've been doing for the last few years, just taking high-resolution pictures of, in this case, of Saturn, whenever the opportunity arises. And it's just one of those things. If you take enough high-resolution pictures, you find something interesting. The way it works is that I take the pictures whenever I can, because you just never know what you're going to find. So every time there's an opportunity, you take the pictures and then I send them out to a mailing list that includes a lot of professional astronomers who might be interested, as well as other amateurs like myself, just to share the images so we can all see what's happening. And also the images end up being contributed into various online databases that the professionals can go and look at, and they can query these databases to say, you know, show me this particular longitude of Saturn on this date, and it'll find the images that have been contributed that are closest. And those online databases are the ones, I think, where these images get drawn from.
And what sort of technology do you need to have at home in order to do this?
Well, the world has changed completely as far as how you take these high-resolution pictures. The key is to have a high-sensitivity, very fast video camera, and you just record a couple of minutes of high-speed video. Now, on Saturn, I typically recorded about 40 or 50 frames per second for about 3 minutes. You do that because Earth's atmosphere is always blurring the image a little bit and making it move around and making it hard to see. So if you record a couple of minutes of video, then we've got some software that can go through that frame by frame and find all the sharpest frames and add these all together to actually get a really nice high-resolution picture. But that all relies on having high-speed computers and just the technology advances that let you put lots of advanced features like this into little, very small, very compact video cameras. The camera that I've got is one of the one that's it's marketed as a machine vision camera, which is a fancy way of saying that it's meant for high detail work in low light conditions. They're not the sort of camera that you'd go down the street and find, but they're certainly just commercially available, and they're really only, you know, less than $1,000, so they're not in the sort of NASA price range.
I take it you put special lenses on it to be able to see something as far away as Saturn?
Well, the lens that I put on it is my telescope that I've got here in my home observatory. It has a 16-inch diameter primary mirror. That catches all the
light.
What
sort of telescope?
It's a Newtonian telescope. Okay,
yeah.
Focal length of 1.6 metres. And I've got an array of lenses I put on top of that that magnifies that focal length out to about 10 metres. And then I plug the camera onto the other end of that.
That's citizen scientist and amateur astronomer Anthony Wesley, proving that anyone can do science if they want to. The Space Shuttle Atlantis, currently docked to the International Space Station, has had its mission extended by a day. Mission STS-135, the last in the 30-year shuttle program, has brought a year's worth of food and supplies to the space station. The Italian space agency-built Raffaello multipurpose logistics module was lifted out of the shuttle's payload bay by the space station's robotic arm and attached to the orbiting outpost's Harmony module. Raffaello's packed with 5 tons of spare parts, equipment and other supplies, including 1.25 tons of food. While other supply ships like Russia's Progress, Europe's ATV or the Japanese HTV will be able to stock the orbiting outpost following the shuttle's retirement, none can carry the amount of cargo the shuttle takes. And none can return experiments and equipment back to the ground. Meanwhile, NASA's damage assessment team have concluded the shuttle's heat shield suffered no major damage from launch debris during its 8.5-minute ride into orbit. Atlantis is now scheduled to land back on Earth on July the 21st at 9:56 GMT, which is 19:56 Australian Eastern Standard Time on Thursday. The Expedition 28 crew aboard the space station have carried out the final spacewalk of the shuttle era. Their 6.5-hour EVA, or extravehicular activity in NASA speak, saw the installation of a $22.6 million experimental satellite refueling system. Designed for use on satellites that were never meant to be refueled or serviced in space, the hardware includes tools and fittings and a tank of ethanol fuel, all designed so that the station's Dexter robot can manipulate them to prepare satellites for in-orbit refueling. Now, this could involve things like cutting away thermal insulation and wires, removing protective caps, installing fuel valves, and, of course, transferring fuel from one tank to another. The system's first major test won't start until after the shuttle leaves the space station. But it's scheduled to keep running for 2 years. NASA plans to hire an industry partner for a follow-on mission around 2015 to refuel a US government satellite and their 9 other spacecraft in orbit. According to NASA, there are currently some 360 operational commercial communication satellites. That's on top of an additional 100 or so government-owned satellites orbiting the Earth. And although they use solar panels to power their electrical circuits, every one of them will run out of fuel needed to power their thrusters in order to boost their orbits and maneuver. Problem is, none of the satellites were designed with refueling in mind. They have no navigational aids, no reflectors, nothing to help guide in an approaching spacecraft, so the technical hurdles are going to be fairly steep. Spacewalking astronauts also collected a faulty ammonia pump attached to the outside of the space station and secured it in the shuttle's payload bay for return to Earth. The spacewalkers also deployed an optical reflector materials experiment installed on the external logistics carrier during Endeavour's last flight on STS-134. The last job on their spacewalk involved installing a cover at the end of the pressurized mating adapter 3. It's designed to cut down the amount of sunlight hitting the area. The EVA marked the 249th spacewalk by NASA astronauts and brought the total time spent on space station-related spacewalks to 1,009 hours and 9 minutes. The last ever spacewalk conducted by shuttle astronauts was back on May the 27th during Endeavour's final visit. The next spacewalk by US astronauts isn't scheduled until later next year. Meanwhile, NASA's been troubleshooting one of 5 primary computers on board Atlantis after it failed late on Thursday, setting off an alarm and awakening the astronauts. The US Space Agency says the General Purpose Computer, or GPC-4, was being used as the system's management computer when it crashed. Crews configured another GPC to operate in the management role and reloaded the software into GPC-4, which now appears to be operating normally. Meanwhile, a chunk of space debris from the Soviet Cosmos 375 satellite, which had posed a threat to the space station's crew, wound up flying past the orbital outpost without incident. Launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan in what was then the Soviet Union back in 1970, the Cosmos 375 was designed to fragment in orbit and destroy another satellite as part of a USSR test of space-based weapon systems. It's one of over 500,000 pieces of space junk large enough for the US Air Force Space Command to track. According to NASA, over any given six-month period, the space station has a 1 in 100 chance of being hit by a piece of space junk big enough to sustain damage that might force the crew to evacuate. And time now on Star Stuff for a look at the rest of the week's science and technology news with the Science Report. A US study has found men are more likely than women to develop and die of cancer. Scientists from the Cancer Research Center in Seattle examined 36 types of the disease using almost 30 years' worth of data. The researchers found that men were twice as likely to develop lung and liver cancers and five times as likely to have cancer of the mouth. Scientists admit they're still not sure exactly what causes the gender gap. There's been a big development in AIDS research. New studies are showing that AIDS drugs can significantly reduce a person's chances of becoming infected with HIV. In fact, the trials were so positive, the results were released early, and patients on a placebo have already been transferred to the vaccines. The ABC's Emily Burke reports.
For the first time, drugs used for treating AIDS have also been found to prevent infection. The researchers enrolled almost 5,000 people who were not infected with HIV but were at high risk of contracting the virus because their partners were HIV positive. The studies found that two particular HIV drugs that are already widely used offered between 62 and 73% protection against the virus if the drugs were taken on a daily basis.
A green sea turtle has been found dead on a New South Wales north coast beach with more than 300 pieces of plastic debris in its digestive system. The turtle was found washed up on a beach at Ballina. Rochelle Ferris from Australian Seabird Rescue says there's no doubt it was the plastics which killed the animal. And she says it's the most shocking case she's seen in 15 years.
We see 40 or 50 sea turtles every year that are suffering from plastic ingestion. This is definitely an extreme of that, but we're only looking at 250 kilometres of coastline. There's a million turtles out there on the barrier reef of this species, and I have no doubt there are more out there in this condition. The governments must take charge of stormwater drainage that goes into our rivers and waterways, which is just feeding a constant stream of this garbage into our marine environment. It has to be better filtering of stormwater drains. I understand the complexity of this issue, but the governments are going to have to increase regulation on the waste treatment that's coming out of urban areas.
Scientists have for the first time sequenced the genome of the humble spud, finding potatoes are far more complex than thought. With an annual yield of about 330 million tons, potatoes are the world's third biggest crop and the most important non-grain staple. For most potato varieties or cultivars, each cell contains four different copies of each of the plant's 12 chromosomes. Now, from a genetics point of view, that complexity makes it difficult to select a particular trait through breeding. A new analysis shows the potato has at least 39,000 protein-coding genes. By mapping the plant's genome, scientists can locate genes controlling traits like colour, starchiness and flavour. And they can create new types of potatoes that are more nutritious, have better resistance to pests and diseases, and are easier to produce. Paleontologists have discovered the fossilised brow horn of a ceratops dinosaur just 13 centimetres below the KT boundary layer. The KT boundary is a thick layer around the entire Earth, which separates the Cretaceous geological period, when dinosaurs still existed, from the Tertiary period, when all the dinosaurs other than birds were gone. Boundary is actually a layer of ash and soot created by the impact of a 10-kilometre-wide asteroid which slammed into what is now Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula 65 million years ago, causing an impact winter which resulted in a mass extinction event wiping out 75% of all life on Earth. It's this asteroid which has long been thought the cause of the dinosaurs' extinction. The problem is, dinosaur fossils were already becoming scarce in sedimentary layers up to 3 metres below the KT boundary layer. And that's prompted some scientists to speculate that they had already become gradually extinct long before the impact event. Reporting in Britain's Royal Society journal Biology Letters, scientists say the new discovery, which was made in the Hell Creek formation of Montana's Badlands, is inconsistent with that 3 metre gap theory. The federal government has cut future funding to two popular science education programs run by the Australian Academy of Sciences. For the past 5 years, the programs were being rolled out in schools across Australia. But the Academy's Professor Jenny Graves says the government now won't continue funding beyond the $13 million already spent, and that leaves the rollout unfinished.
The federal government has said that they now consider this a state matter, which really doesn't make a lot of sense to us because it's always been a federally funded program that we want to roll out uniformly out of, over the whole of Australia. As soon as it becomes a state matter, that means we have many, many more people to deal with.
Scientists in Africa have created a powerful, if somewhat smelly, new weapon against disease-spreading mosquitoes. It's a trap that uses the odour of smelly socks. Researchers found the synthetically created smell attracts 4 times as many insects as normal odours emitted by humans. The smell draws insects to the socks, which are filled with poison and placed outdoors. A Canadian government agency has helped fund the research, which, if successful, will provide a low-cost and low-tech way of controlling mosquito-spread viruses such as malaria. And for more news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. If you missed us on radio, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always full of the latest news, spectacular images, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit into the show. You can find it at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lower case, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed. For the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen, we give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word and in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.